But while the Ireland of Swift and Goldsmith was part and lot with the England of Pope, Dr. Johnson, and Sir Joshua Reynolds, while there has never been, and is not now, any real definable difference except one of geography between the governing class in Ireland and in Britain, the Irish underworld and the English underworld were essentially dissimilar. The upward struggle of the English democracy to education, to political recognition, was different in many respects from the struggle of the Irish underworld. Britain was producing a great industrial population, Protestant or sceptical. She had agricultural labourers indeed, but no peasants. Ireland, with no coal, with a poorer soil and landlords who lived in England, had become a land of rent-paying peasants. Their cultivation was allowed to degenerate more and more into a growing of potatoes and a feeding of pigs. The people married and bred, except for the consumption of whiskey when it could be got, and a little fighting, family life was their only amusement. Here are the appalling consequences. The population of Ireland in 1785 was 2,845,932. In 1803 was 5,536,594. In 1845 was 8,295,061, at which date the weary potato gave way under its ever-growing burthen, and there was a frightful famine. Many died, many emigrated, especially to the United States. An outflow of emigration began that made Ireland for a time a land of old people and empty nests. Now, because of the union of the parliaments, the enfranchisement of the English and Irish populations went on simultaneously. Catholic enfranchisement in England meant Catholic enfranchisement in Ireland. The British got votes because they wanted them. The Irish commonalty got votes because the English did. Ireland was overrepresented in the Union Parliament because originally Irish seats had been easier for the governing class to manipulate than English. And so it came about that this Irish and Catholic Ireland, which had never before had any political instrument at all, and which had never sought a political instrument, suddenly found itself with the power to thrust a solid body of members into the legislature of Great Britain. After the general election of 1874, the old type of venal Irish member was swept aside, and the newly enfranchised democracy of Britain found itself confronted by a strange and perplexing Irish democracy, different in its religion, its traditions, and its needs, telling a tale of wrongs of which the common English had never heard, clamouring passionately for a separation which they couldn't understand and which impressed them chiefly as being needlessly unfriendly. The national egotism of the Irish is intense. Their circumstances have made it intense. They were incapable of considering the state of affairs in England. The new Irish party came into the British Parliament to obstruct and disorder English business until Ireland became free and to make themselves a nuisance to the English. This spirit was only too welcome to the oligarchy which still ruled the British Empire. They allied themselves with the loyal Protestants in the north of Ireland, loyal, that is, to the imperial government because of their dread of a Catholic predominance in Ireland, and they watched and assisted the gradual exasperation of the British common people by this indiscriminate hostility of the common people of Ireland. The story of the relation of Ireland to Britain for the last half century is one that reflects the utmost discredit upon the governing class of the British Empire, but it's not one of which the English commons need be ashamed. Again and again, they've given evidences of goodwill. British legislation in relation to Ireland for nearly half a century shows a series of clumsy attempts on the part of liberal England made in the face of a strenuous opposition from the Conservative Party and the Ulster Irish to satisfy Irish complaints and get to a footing of fellowship. The name of Parnell, an Irish Protestant, stands out as that of the chief leader of the Home Rule movement. In 1886, Gladstone, the Liberal British Prime Minister, brought political disaster upon himself by introducing the first Irish Home Rule Bill, a genuine attempt to give over Irish affairs for the first time in history to the Irish people. The bill broke the Liberal Party asunder, and a coalition government under the Unionist government replaced that of Mr. Gladstone. This digression into the history of Ireland now comes up to the time of infectious imperialism in Europe. The Unionist government, which ousted Mr. Gladstone, had a predominantly Tory element and was in spirit imperialist, as no previous British government had been. The British political history of the subsequent years is largely a history of the conflict of the new imperialism through which an arrogant British nationalism sought to override the rest of the empire against the temperamental liberalism and reasonableness of the English, which tended to develop the empire into a confederation of free and willing allies. Naturally, the British imperialists wanted a subjugated Irish. Naturally, the English liberals wanted a free, participating Irish. In 1892, Gladstone struggled back to power with a small Home Rule majority, and in 1893 his second Home Rule Bill passed the Commons and was rejected by the Lords. It wasn't, however, until 1895 that an imperialist government took office. The party which sustained it was called not imperialist, but unionist, an odd name when we consider how steadily and strenuously it has worked to destroy any possibility of an empire commonweal. These imperialists remained in power for 10 years. We have already noted their conquest of South Africa. They were defeated in 1905 in an attempt to establish a tariff wall on the Teutonic model. The ensuing Liberal government then turned the conquered South African Dutch into contented fellow subjects by creating the self-governing Dominion of South Africa, after which it embarked upon a long impending struggle with the persistently imperialist House of Lords. This was a very fundamental struggle in British affairs. On the one hand, were the liberal majority of the people of Great Britain honestly and wisely anxious to put this Irish affair upon a new and more hopeful footing, and if possible to change the animosity of the Irish into friendship. On the other hand, were all the factors of this new British imperialism resolved at any cost, and in spite of every electoral verdict, legally if possible, but if not illegally, to maintain their ascendancy over the affairs of the English, Scotch and Irish and all the rest of the empire alike. It was, under new names, the age-long internal struggle of the English community, that same conflict of a free and liberal-spirited commonalty against powerful big men and big adventurers and authoritative persons which we've already dealt with in our account of the liberation of America.